The FlightBridge Ed Air and Surface Transport Symposium is back, May 18th through 20th of 2020. Join us in Murfreesboro, Tennessee for our third installment of one of the best EMS conferences in the nation. Guys, I gotta tell you, get to the FlightBridgeEd.com website, click on the Fast 20 button, check out all of the pre-conference offerings. We have more than ever this year. Our speaker lineup is going to be incredible. If you've been to Fast 18, to Fast 19, you do not want to miss Fast 20. Go to FlightBridgeEd.com, click on Fast 20, get your tickets now. We'll see you in Murfreesboro.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. While I was at the Texas EMS Conference, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Ben Bobro, the Department Chair of Emergency Medicine at the McGovern Medical School at UT Health. Dr. Bobro is a recent Texas transplant, and he comes to us from Arizona, where he served in various roles there, including the state EMS medical director. He was also involved in several research and improvement efforts that have directly impacted the medicine we practice at Williamson County. The EPIC study quantified the dangers of hypoxia, hypotension, or both on patients with traumatic brain injury and showed how simple interventions aimed at avoiding these things improved mortality. Now, we talked about the EPIC trial here on the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast on episode 8. I would urge you to go back and take a listen because the work he did really is important. Now, he was also involved in some studies looking at improving cardiac arrest outcomes by focusing on several things, including minimally interrupted chest compressions, immediate resumption of compressions after shock, passive oxygenation for the first 6 minutes of the arrest, and paying attention to the quality of chest compressions. Now, here in Texas, Dr. Bobro is already making an impact. We had been struggling to get funding for a state subscription to CARES. One of the first things Dr. Bobro did was commit UT Health to sponsoring the startup cost for Texas CARES. Now, thanks to his support, Texas is now a CARES state. That means all agencies in the state can join for free, and they can get data on their cardiac arrest performance, including hospital outcome information. Now, I sat down with Dr. Bobro in the corridors of the Fort Worth Convention Center in between lectures to discuss his research efforts and the role Texas CARES can have on improving survival from cardiac arrest. We were recording in a pretty loud environment, and I was just using lavalier mics going into my iPhone. Needless to say, there was some, let's just call it extracurricular audio. I tried to edit out as much of that as I could, but to be honest with you, I'm still on the steep end of the audio engineering learning curve. I hope y'all will forgive the audio quality and be able to focus on the great things that Dr. Bobro has to say. By the way, I'm disappointed that we didn't have time to bring Mike and Ritu in at the end of our last episode from the Texas EMS Conference. To make up for that, we're going to have both of them join us at the end of my interview with Dr. Bobro. I'm sure they're going to have some outstanding things to say about this wonderful content. Now, that's assuming we have time, of course. So, let's get this thing started. On with the show.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Welcome to the podcast, and most importantly, welcome to Texas.
Thank you, Jeff. Super excited to be here with my friend Jeff Jarvis at Texas EMS, the largest state EMS conference in perhaps the planet.
So, you know, we always say Texas, it's like a whole other country, and we decided that if we're going to be our own country, we may as well have our own national EMS conference just disguised as a state conference.
It's big. How many people are here?
There are about 2,000 people at this conference.
That's awesome.
Kelly Harrell and Billy Slotik are the folks who put this on, and they have been doing an outstanding job of this for 20, 25 years now.
I've
been coming to it for, I don't really want to think this, but probably close to 30 years.
Well, I'm super impressed and very excited to be here.
They do an absolutely outstanding job. Well, so when you were in Arizona, you did some pretty good work. You did some work that we have discussed on our podcast about the EPIC trial. We have also talked about CPR and some of the things that are important about CPR. So a lot of folks, when we think about CPR, we talk about cardiopulmonary resuscitation. And you did some work in Arizona that is changing the focus from CPR to continuous and cardiocerebral resuscitation. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means and what your work was in Arizona?
Well, first of all, it wasn't really my work. It was work out of, that so many people contributed to in Arizona. I literally, Jeff, I was just the guy at the right place at the right time. And what was going on in the late 1990s and early 2000s is the CPR research team at the University of Arizona was led by a guy named Gordon Avey. And terrific, terrific man who had been doing a lot of animal basic science research, mostly in the pig labs, on looking at continuous chest compression CPR.
Okay.
And specifically, they were measuring blood flow, both coronary and cerebral blood flow in the animals. And so they've been publishing a lot of animal science, and they were really wanting to do some clinical research. And they sort of just, you know, it's complex. Doing EMS research is complex. These guys were cardiologists and researchers. And so I just sort of, by chance, met them. And I was the state EMS medical director at the time, early 2000s, and I saw what they were doing. They invited me down to their pig lab down in Tucson. I was fascinated with what they were showing me. Basically, you know, it's so impressive when you look at brief pauses in CPR and you watch blood flow just precipitously go down, and you see how long it takes to come back up. And so they had been publishing this stuff. And
so let's talk about that a little bit, because I think if you have not read this research, you might think that you get the cerebral blood flow with every compression, and that if you interrupt compressions, I think everybody would see that blood flow stops. But most people might assume as soon as you resume compressions, blood flow gets picks right back up where it left off. So that's not at all what y'all found.
Yes, it's actually a double hit. When you stop CPR for any reason, you get a very rapid decline in blood flow, which is one thing. And you can say, well, I was off the chest for 10 seconds, but I'm back on.
Right.
But it doesn't go right back up.
It probably wasn't 10 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. But then it takes a good period of time, sometimes 20 seconds or more, for that blood flow to come back up. And so you sort of have the double hit of the pause plus the decreased blood flow. And then you would look at the differences in blood flow with different types of chest compressions, you know, the rate and the depth and the release velocity, and it kind of really came together. So at that time, we were just doing our first studies of incidence and outcomes in Arizona, because until that time, actually, no state had done a statewide analysis, and we were bad. We were really bad, as almost everyone was.
Yep.
What
is,
we found,
I think, is probably a better verb there.
We've had some improvements. Some stellar, you know, cities and jurisdictions have improved dramatically, but overall, we still have a long way to go. But what happened was we basically showed that 97% of everyone that had out of hospital cardiac arrest died.
97%. This is all comers.
Yes.
So all comers survival rate 3%.
Right. And witness BF survival rate was like 7 or 8%.
Okay.
And so one of the things we did was, and this was, I think, maybe the best thing we did, is we said, you know what, we have to do better, and we have to look for ways to improve. And that's what really led us to at least being open to trying some new things. And that new, the first new thing that we really tried was to had to adopt a protocol and sort of a mindset and a training around minimizing breaks in chest compressions for anything. Now, everyone at this point in 2019 says, oh, yeah, well, that's interesting. When we did it in 2003, right. It was not at all
correct,
well
yeah.
accepted.
No.
In fact, we, even for adult witnessed VF, we were doing what's called passive oxygenation. We were putting an OPA and a non-rebreather on, as opposed to stopping for advanced airways.
And that, my friend, is sacrilege.
Oh, no, I had ripe fruit thrown at me. But what happened was fascinating, Jeff. A good number of the agencies across the state, when we would present all this data, the animal data and the concept, they said, hey, you know what? That makes sense to us. We want to try that, with the rationale that, you know what? We haven't had almost any survivors. In fact, some of the cities had no survivors. So they said, well, it's hard to do worse. So they started. And some of the other agencies in the state continued to do standard ACLS CPR, which was, of course,
evolving.
It does
make for a nice natural experiment.
Well, it made for a natural experiment. Yeah. And so my job was to measure this over time. We did this over about a five-year period, and we measured that first round over 3,000 out-of-hospital arrests, and we showed that for adults who had witnessed collapse, that the survival rate to hospital discharge was over three times better when they got what we called it was minimally interrupted cardiac resuscitation. This is actually fascinating because we had a lot of words, alphabet soup.
Right.
We had CCR, we had CCR for cardiocerebral resuscitation.
Right.
And again, that's what Dr. Avey named it initially, because
I may have been mispronouncing. How does he spell that?
EWI.
Okay, I definitely
yeah,
been mispronouncing it. Okay.
All right. But his whole thing was we're resuscitating the brain and the heart, not the brain,
right.
Not the heart and the lungs.
Right.
So he wanted it called cardiocerebral resuscitation. So when we went to publish the first non-randomized prospective outcome paper, JAMA said, well, we like it. We want to publish this. We believe that this is accurate, but we don't like the name cardiocerebral resuscitation because that implies that you're resuscitating people that are having a better neurologic outcome than they had before the cardiac arrest, which it didn't even really make any difference. Yeah, you're not going to get better. You're not going to suddenly go to Stanford after you have a cardiac arrest
no,
and get smarter.
It's like, hey, doc, will I be able to play the piano after
yes,
my surgery?
Exactly. So,
wow.
But,
boy, they won up to reviewer number three there, didn't they?
Yeah. But the point was they wanted to publish this paper, and so they asked for a different name, called something else. And it was Bob Berg, super, super smart guy that was on Gordon Avey's team. Bob said, we should call this minimally interrupted cardiac resuscitation. JAMA said, great, let's call it MICR. And that's what it became called.
Fair
but
enough.
Then people still had all kinds of different names for it. But in essence, all we were doing, Jeff, was minimizing all interruptions.
Okay.
We actually were not doing no ventilation CPR. We did front-loaded cardiac chest compressions after 6 to 8 minutes, we would then do positive pressure ventilation.
Right.
But we would basically do the first 6 to 8 minutes with continuous chest compressions for no interruptions except for rhythm analysis and shock if indicated,
right.
And then immediate post-shock chest compressions. Again, a lot of these things have made their way into the most recent guidelines,
right.
But in 2003, this was a pretty out there protocol.
So what we're talking about here is a bundle of care,
yeah.
And the bundle of care is the minimally interrupted compressions. So stay on the chest, come off, pre-charge your monitor, see an immediate post-shock resumption, apneic oxygenation with just a nasal cannula or a non-rebreather for the first 6 to 8 minutes, mm-hmm. Prompt defibrillation, and then I think you said you had a focus on the CPR metrics,
yes.
Also,
and
is that right?
The only, well, at the beginning we didn't. That
okay.
came in later. And the only drug we advocated for was IO epi.
Okay.
With the idea that, and I still think Dr. Avey was, I think he was right about this. If epi does anything, it's got to be given early.
Yep.
And that was the focus, was that it's one of the first things, if you have enough manpower on scene, was to do an IO-line and an epi
right.
at the beginning.
Yeah, and that's obviously not more important than compressions, but that's borne out by, we don't have any RCT data, but we have a decent Japanese registry study that shows exactly that. It's the only thing that I've seen epinephrine can improve neurologic outcome with, is if it's given within first 10 minutes.
It seems to help in hospital, and I think that's because we start sooner in the hospital.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and what you showed was a 3% or threefold.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, improvement in
neurologic
all cause
survival.
Yeah, so that's
actually
impressive.
In VF, from witnessed VF.
How do you know statewide that you improve survival? I mean,
well,
you have to have some data for that, right?
It was the found. It's the foundation of everything. We were collecting data. So we're collecting pre-hospital first care reports. This is actually non-electronic stuff. We did this by hand. First care reports and entered them into a database, a custom database, and then we got hospital outcome data, including a neurologic CPC score on discharge, and we did some probabilistic linkage, and we created our own. So now we have a national CARES registry.
Right.
In 2003, we created our own state registry. It was incredibly time-consuming, but it was effective, and so we stuck with it. But of course, I think what you're getting at is the foundation for all improvements in resuscitation is careful, methodical measurement of incidence, process of care, and outcomes.
Wouldn't it be great? Now, this is just way out there, Ben, so, but work with me here. Wouldn't it be great if there were a national database where people could just say, go to a website and put in the data from their system, and the hospitals could put in outcome data on those patients that the system took to the hospital, and maybe this big cloud-based solution would give them automatically generated reports.
I have an idea.
We
could call it the Cardiac Arrest Registry to enhance survival.
Cardiac arrest.
Wait, damn,
oh, that's an
Jeff,
acronym.
Jeff, damn, somebody's already thought
of
that.
Oh, that's right. Brian McNally is over there going, oh, you putzes, come on. It is. So CARES started 2005. Yeah. It started at Emory in
the
Atlanta.
CDC actually.
CDC funded it.
Funded the beginning of it.
I believe CDC, that funding went away, went to industry, and now it's moving more towards a state subscription model.
Exclusively towards state subscription.
So a state subscription model, and I believe there are 23 states now mm-hmm. that do this. The idea is that the state, some entity in the state, subscribes and pays a pittance, and I want to say the pittance is $15,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do that, every EMS agency in the state can submit their data, and every hospital that they transport to will also submit their data.
And they both get outcome reports
on
the success of their resuscitations.
And these are some, I love, so they format these outcome reports. Beautiful consort
flowchart.
It is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been trying to bring Texas CARES to Texas for a long time.
You have been.
Well, I have been, and I've been failing at it.
I'm a Johnny come lately.
Well, you came lately, and then you actually have managed to get us over the hump. So tell us what this Texas CARES thing is, because it's about measurement, but it's not just about measurement, right?
It's actually probably the main reason I came here, Jeff, is I saw this opportunity. I had some
I thought you did it just because you wanted to be able to wear boots to conferences.
Well, I wanted to do that too. Actually, I like these boots. I had an opportunity to join UT Health, which was really exciting to me, but I saw the bigger opportunity across the state was Texas was the largest state in the country to not have its own CARES registry. And you know, I had worked with the National CARES Group for a long time, and I heard about you, that you were trying to do this. I heard they really wanted to start this, and I thought this could be my next you know, several years of what I want to do. And you know, Texas is 5 times bigger than Arizona. So we did some great work in Arizona. The whole state did. We quadrupled survival to hospital discharge. We had over 4,000 cardiac arrest survivors in the state. It was amazing stuff. But I thought, well, what if we did this in Texas? And so, you know, it's a little bit of, you had a taste of success. Now you really want to do more. And in some ways, it's wash, rinse, repeat. It's starting over. You know, it's trying to convince people, get people on board, build some momentum, build partnerships. It's not rocket science stuff. It will work. It will save many people, many lives.
So it seems like there's an analogy here. When it comes to working an individual patient in cardiac arrest, it's not rocket science. It's not the fancy stuff. It's not the epinephrine or the intubation or the airway. It's about basic early recognition, bystander CPR, and early defibrillation. It's the easy stuff. And
well,
what
not
you're
easy.
Saying...
I would say, I like to say
simple.
It's simple. It's
right.
Simple, but it's not easy.
So it is amazing how hard it is to do those simple things at scale. And I mean scale as in a single agency. But it's even harder to do it at scale across a state. So we always think, well, the key has to be a widget. It has to be a doodad. And it really is the simple things.
Yeah.
And
we
sometimes
get distracted.
The simple things
we get distracted
hard.
By the technology that we think is going to save us, whether it's
right.
an app or whatever. That not that that stuff can't be helpful.
Sure.
But this is not easy stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard work. It's training. It's data collection. It takes commitment to this. But I can tell that the leadership in Texas, the EMS leadership, want to do this. They're going to drive this. This will get better and better. It's just really, now it's a question of how well can we disseminate this and get people to make this a commitment, an organizational commitment.
So we've talked about CARES, and obviously CARES is a component of Texas CARES, but there's another component. There's an improvement piece that you were also involved in. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academies of Science, issued a report in 2015. The report went to Congress, and it was a massive report, 440 pages, about the whole topic of cardiac arrest, both inside the hospital, outside the hospital, all the reasons that we have not made the types of improvements that we can make. The intention of this paper, it was called A Time to Act, Strategies to Improve Cardiac Arrest in America. The whole intention was to have this change the trajectory of cardiac resuscitation, kind of like, To Err Is Human, if you remember that report.
Right.
That one.
Complete with its 747 analogy.
Yes, but that report, To Err Is Human, I think it was in the late 90s, that changed the whole trajectory of medical errors. It changed the way we approach medical errors. It changed everything. The government then set up a whole institute about medical errors. And our hope for writing this IOM paper, we spent about 2 years writing it, was that it would change everything. I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's evolving. So one of the things that came out of the IOM report, the number one recommendation was a national cardiac arrest registry. All right?
What a coincidence.
So that's the number one thing,
yep.
And that's the foundation of all this. But the number three recommendation was to improve EMS capabilities. And what I mean is to improve things like 911, telecommunicator CPR, recognition, ability to get CPR started, training, and EMS high performance CPR. So that was recommendation number three of this whole report, to improve the whole everything. And so that report went to Congress. Congress then tasked NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety, the closest thing we have to a national EMS agency, to then develop these curriculum performance standards and training curriculum and performance standards. And so then I was part of a group that spent another 18 months writing that curriculum, and it's not just a written curriculum, it's a toolkit. It's an implementation toolkit, and a lot of it's based on a lot of things that people that we've all done together, but really a lot of things that the King County Seattle group had pioneered and really driven for a long, long time. And so a lot of us got together with some really expert adult learning educators and folks from Laerdal that had do a lot of thinking around operationalizing training and learning. And we developed this, what was called, what we termed CPR Lifelinks.
Okay.
CPR Lifelinks is NHTSA's training curriculum and performance standards for 911 and EMS. It's the first federally endorsed product of its kind. It's not really a product, it's free.
Right.
And it's really—
It's on EMS.gov.
It's at EMS.gov and 911.gov, and it's what every system should do, is the core of their resuscitation. So it's not to imply that there aren't other things to do, really important other things, but it is the core, the foundation of all of our out-of-hospital resuscitation.
Outstanding.
So and I just want to say, and so my vision for this, and your vision, all of our shared vision, is that Texas CARES be the first state that is not just a passive registry. We're not just entering data for the sake of entering data. We're not doing, you know, just quality improvement for the sake of doing quality improvement. We're entering data into the registry and doing this performance improvement, CPR performance improvement, along the entire pre-hospital chain of survival. And so it's, I think our opportunity is to link both of this together. Both the measurement and the quality improvement together. And that's really the, you know, the intention. And I know that CARES wants to look at how this can work in a state like Texas and can become the model for all the other states. So now we have the opportunity to really lead the rest of the country.
Absolutely. And as a Texan, I think that's the, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity to show that we are, of course, better than the other 49 lesser states.
Well, it's a great leadership opportunity.
Isn't it, though?
That could, we could not just improve, you know, dramatically improve resuscitation and survival in Texas, but show other states, you know, how to do this.
Absolutely. It's a great opportunity. Was there a challenge getting people to buy in to not actively bagging people?
There was. You know, for a long time, of course, you know, our whole paradigm was airway, 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 ventilation, ventilation. But of course, we know now that, you know, and breathing, breathing is the core of everything.
Right.
So there was a challenge in getting people to sort of to switch around to the CBA or CAB, you know, paradigm. But one of the things, we had data to show that, you know, it wasn't so much oxygenation that was the issue, it was perfusion. And there is dissolved oxygen in the blood that really just needs to be disseminated. Now, the other thing is, we did show people, and this has been, you know, lots of folks did this, Tom Ofter, Heidi, lots of people showed this, that, you know, ventilation is super important, oxygen is really important, but too much ventilation is really bad. It's harmful. And so, you know, one of the issues is we're just not good at ventilating. We're really bad at it.
Yeah.
And we cause harm when we ventilate both too fast and too forcefully and too much volume. And so I think in an ideal world, probably some ventilation, the right amount at the right time, would probably be optimal. But you have to be really proficient at doing all of that together. And we're often not.
Absolutely. Which is a really juicy area for research, particularly in secondary analyses of some of these ROC trials, going in and being able to take a look at the impact that respiratory rate and depth have played a part.
And the other thing I want to add is, you know, the other reason it made a lot of sense, especially with advanced airways, you know, we spent a lot of time focusing on advanced airways, and, you know, a lot of Henry Wang's papers showed that even in the ROC, the Resuscitation Outcome Consortium, arguably some of the most facile EMS systems in the country, they had prolonged pauses in CPR for advanced airway insertion, often over a minute. And if you're not doing anything for over a minute, you're likely going to cause harm. And then once you get an airway in, we then have the ability to overventilate and really cause harm by increasing intrathoracic pressure, decreasing forward blood flow, decreasing cerebral perfusion.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question, and it's something that I am dying to answer. looking particularly at the PART data, we think, so we saw that there was a, 2.8% absolute difference in survival with the King LT over the intubation. However, there was also a 51% first pass success rate with intubation versus an 86% with King LT. And from some work that just got presented, we see that that first pass success rate can account for about 70% of the difference.
Good. So you saw the abstract from the RESS.
But yeah, I was very excited about that. So that's a big part. The other question, so if I want to say 74% attribution, okay, well, that's not 100%. So that means there's something else involved. What is the something else? So what you do with a tube could certainly be a part, and then compression and eruption. So that is some really juicy work that hopefully is coming that can answer that. But really what I wanted to get at is when we look at, go back to epinephrine, and you look at the first full-on randomized control trial in Australia, the Perkins paper, that was initially most of Australia and New Zealand, and they had to pare it back because paramedics basically said it is unethical to withhold epinephrine, we're not going to do it. So I think that's always an interesting thing that you have to, whether it's apneic oxygenation or withholding epinephrine, I think you have to get buy-in from the medics in the system and explain why this is either a good thing or a good thing in the case of apneic oxygenation, or we are at equipoise and don't know in the case of epinephrine.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us. It's been fascinating, and I look forward to the opportunity to sit down and talk with you on a different session about the work you did in Arizona with traumatic brain injury and the EPIC. I have EPI on the brain, the EPIC registry.
Let's do it. I just want to thank the listeners, all of our EMS rescuers, and for their incredible work. And, you know, I think, Jeff, our job is to give people the best tools, you know, to be as successful as they can, to save the most lives. They're, you know, these are the folks that are on the, you know, on the front line saving lives. And we gotta help them, you know, have the right tools and the right, you know, techniques and, you know, the right concepts to be as successful as possible.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Dr. Barbaro, thank you again. Fascinating talking with you as always.
Awesome. Thank you.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.